thank you very, very much for that extremely nice introduction. It is true that I tend to choose my topics based on the things that I'm curious about and worry about identification and publication later in the research process. It's something you can do once you have a fixed position at places you are happy with, and I am actually happy with being both at... So the Research Institute of Industrial Economics, that's a small, privately funded research institute in Stockholm. And then I'm also at Lund University, which is a really old, 40,000, possibly 45,000 students, really old university in Sweden. So sometimes it's nice to have the small, private, very flexible organization, and sometimes it's nice to have the reputation of a fairly big, old universities. On the bad days, however, I do get the worst from both worlds, and that's when I prefer to work at home. So, and also, as was mentioned in the introduction, I started basically doing research on the welfare state. Where does the welfare state come from? What consequences does big government and social transfers have for economic growth, for example? And after spending quite a few years writing, publishing stuff on the welfare state, I moved on to related areas, such as what are the big challenges for the welfare state today? And Sweden being one of the biggest and most interesting welfare states in social science is also discussing currently the challenges that welfare states face when people arrive from countries that are typically much poorer and less developed than the rich countries such as Sweden and basically all the OECD countries. And since I started doing this, there was increasingly critical situation in Syria with several refugees actually coming to Sweden, so the topic has gained political interest as I've been working on it. And this is basically one of my first attempts to understand the outcomes for immigrants in their new countries. Okay? Feel free to ask questions during my presentation, and if you have really long questions or basically opinions of your own, I will be eager to hear them as well, but then perhaps we can do that towards the end of the presentation. But I'm happy either way. So the title here, this is very much work in progress, and that's why I actually prefer to present it, because papers that are 97% complete, you don't want too many comments on at that stage. But this, I'm really eager to hear your ideas and suggestions. And the title is, Why Are Immigrants Doing Worse Where They Are More Welcome? And I'll explain what I mean. And this is basically a paper on the outcome, the labor market outcomes of immigrants in the OECD countries. So I'm going to give you the research questions in a slide or two, but I'm going to explain to you how I got this idea. And as many of you know, there are big gaps on the labor markets in developed countries if you compare natives, people who were born in the rich country, to immigrants, people who were born outside. And you can quantify these gaps in different ways. You can look at the employment ratio for natives and for immigrants. And typically, natives will be employed to a much higher extent than immigrants. And if you just calculate the ratio of native employment to immigrant employment, a ratio higher than one will mean that natives are employed to a higher extent. So we see that there are some really nice countries where actually immigrants are employed to a larger extent than natives. United States, Portugal, and so on. Hungary doing really good here in that sense. But in most OECD countries, natives are employed to a higher extent than immigrants. And Poland and Sweden and Belgium are those where the gap between natives and immigrants on the labor market is the biggest. And another way to calculate the labor market gap between immigrants and laborers, immigrants and natives, is of course to look at unemployment. And these are the same OECD countries. They are still arranged according to the employment gap, but now I have instead taken the unemployment of natives compared to the unemployment of immigrants. And so here, a ratio higher than one means that immigrants are unemployed twice as much or twice as likely, or to be more precise, that immigrant unemployment rate is the native unemployment rate times 2.2 in Sweden. Poland doing much better here, Norway doing terribly bad, with immigrant unemployment a factor 3.5, as high as those who are born in Norway.
Which year?
So these are both taken from 2010. Sorry? Yeah, exactly. So these are OECD official data from the year 2010, which was actually the latest available when I started this project. So why are these different? Well, as you might know, employment is basically anybody who has some kind of job as a share of the population. Whereas unemployment is calculated as those who are looking for a job but don't have one as a share of the labor force. So you can do bad on the labor market in several ways. You could not even be in the labor force, or you can be in the labor force but unemployed. So they are related, but they are not the same thing, right? But the countries that are having problems according to this measure, on average, they are also having problems according to this measure. So there is something fundamentally or institutionally or structurally that prevent immigrants from doing as good as natives on the labor markets in the OECD countries. I should also say that these are relative gaps. These are ratios between unemployment and employment ratios. If you look at the levels, there will be a slightly different picture. So for example, Sweden, that I know well, is not doing too bad in terms of levels. But on the other hand, you will notice that these countries, Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark, they are countries with fairly extensive welfare states, and thus they are basically based on having higher employment rate, having both men and women working, for example. So a big gap in these countries is actually a problem for the long run financing of the welfare state, which is why many of these countries are worried about the situation currently. So then I discovered a puzzle, which is that if you correlate these labor market gaps with actually any measure I could find on attitudes towards immigrants, it turns out that it looks like this. The gap is higher where people are more positive towards immigrants. So in this case, I pulled from European Social Survey the share of the population that express the opinion that immigration from countries outside Europe, which is typically interpreted as low-skill immigration, is a good thing for our country. And it turns out in some countries people strongly disagree, and in some countries most people agree that immigration is a good thing. But the slightly surprising thing is that those countries where people are more positive towards low-skill immigration, they are the countries where the gaps between immigrants and natives are on average bigger. Okay? And actually, I could reproduce this relationship with any measure of attitudes that I could find, and it also holds for both the unemployment and the employment-based measure of the labor market gap. So here's another one. This is the share agreeing with the proposition that immigration is positive without specifying where they come from at all. And this is the labor market gap measured as the ratio between unemployment levels. So we see again that the countries where immigrants are unemployed to a much higher extent than natives, they are actually the countries where more people agree that immigration is positive. And this also holds for a measure that I pulled out from the World Value Survey, where they ask about various groups if people would be okay with having them as neighbors. They ask about gay people, jazz musicians, I don't know, immigrants. And it turns out that in Turkey, for example, 40% state that they would not like to have immigrants as neighbors, whereas in Sweden, only a few percent state this. But it's still the same correlation. So there was something fishy going on here, which is basically the reason for asking this question. Why are immigrants doing worse on the labor markets in countries where they are more welcome, according to the public attitudes? And that's what I'm trying to explain. Comprehensible so far? Any questions? So my explanation, because I think I have an idea, is that this has to do with labor market institutions and welfare state generosity. And the theory basically departs from the very simple model of immigration that appears, for example, in Boja's 95 article, where he discusses the idea of an immigration surplus. And the immigration surplus is very specific. It is the economic gain in a society that comes from having an inflow of labor, an inflow that is allowed to change the relative wages so that wages actually fall, and as a result, costs fall, production increases, and profits increase. Okay? And that, of course, means that in the Boja's model, the capitalists win, the new laborers also win, but the native laborers lose because they are basically facing pressure downwards on their wages. But there is a surplus created from the fact that you allow wages to fall. And the Boja's model is very partial. Of course, if profits increase and costs are lower because of new labor, increased labor supply, it is likely that this will, in the long run at least, benefit consumers as well. I mean, labor costs are lower, competition should actually mean lower prices. And there is actually some empirical evidence that this is true from the United States. If you have a large inflow of low-skill labor, you can also see falling prices in certain parts of the service sector where these immigrants are basically working. So through the competitive pressure, the benefits from immigration is basically dispersed in the economy and also to some extent falls on consumers. But it is still the case that native workers are hurt directly by the wage competition. There is some discussion going on about the extent to which foreigners are actually a substitute to native labor. Turns out they may only be imperfect, so that they are not fully competing with native workers. But the other side is, sure, natives are now less threatened by immigrant labor, but it also means that the immigration surplus is lower because you don't allow immigrants to bid down wages as much as they could. And this is basically what I depart from in my theory when I want to explain differences between countries. Because we know that the benefits from immigration, those that appear in the Borges model and also others you could think of, they tend to be dispersed and take time to appear. Whereas the costs are concentrated to native workers in the sectors where the immigrants are competing, and they are very direct. And that leads me to propose that if native workers are well organized and politically influential, they will demand and to a higher extent succeed with their demands for protective labor market institutions. Any kind of rule that prevents immigrants from competing for jobs by offering to work for lower wages. And to the extent that they succeed with this, then immigrants become less of a threat for native workers. And as a result, you can have more immigrant-friendly attitudes. So one way of understanding this is to basically assume that people in a baseline are not strongly hostile towards immigrants. But when they are competing with your job or when they are driving down wages in your sector, there may be a self-incentive that basically trumps your immigrant-friendly attitude. Now, if you have institutions that basically take care of them and by not allowing immigrants to compete, then your baseline immigrant-friendly attitude will prevail. Whereas if you have institutions that are not protective but more competitive, there will be more hostility towards immigrants. That's the basic idea, basically. I'm not going to do the models in math. I'm going to do it with arrows and discuss a few other implications from what I just said. So if you have, which you have in some countries, a well-organized labor movement that has been politically influential, you should see more protective labor market institutions in those countries. And as a result from these institutions, you should see immigrants having a harder time finding a job and entering the labor force. And as a result, these countries will have a lower immigrant surplus, and basically immigrants will end up unemployed to a larger extent. These countries should have more immigrant-friendly attitudes on average because workers have less to worry about when it comes to direct competition from foreign laborers. And these countries should also have lower income inequality because the immigrant surplus is created when there are competitive labor market institutions because immigrants are bidding down wages in some areas. And even if you assume that they also push native labor somewhere else where they are more productive, that actually reinforces the mechanism that income inequality increases. There will be more lower wages, and there may be more people with higher wages that basically are even more productive when there are immigrants doing the simple tasks. Whereas if you have protective labor market institutions, immigrants are not allowed to change the wage structure, and as a result, these countries will have a more compressed income distribution. Yes?
What would you say if the protective labor market creates or encourages dualism of the labor market, right? So there is higher polarization.
Yep.
And then immigrants compete with those in the lower segment of the labor market.
Yep.
And at the end, we do increase in inequality. The protection, it's only on the partial, right?
So if it leads to dualism, it should lead to still increased inequality, but in a slightly different way. You should see a bigger segment of low-skilled jobs, but perhaps still fairly compressed middle-income distribution. That would be the implication, actually.
The thing is that the protection is on the whole market?
Or yeah.
If
yeah.
the protection goes...
So far, market, but that is actually a very good point about dualism, because that we see a lot, actually. That basically allows immigrants to compete for partial contracts and in some sectors, but not perhaps the entire labor market.
May I also ask?
Yep.
I think the story is that if you protect natives, they are more friendly to immigrants because they are protected, but it could work also differently. If it makes more immigrants unemployed, it makes the natives pay for their welfare benefits, and they may grumble based on this.
Yeah, I agree. That's actually the next mechanism.
Ah, I see. Because
you are indeed right. If these countries with well-organized labor movement also have more generous social safety nets, which they do, they will also serve to keep them out, because they can basically live on some type of welfare benefit instead of having to work. These will also contribute to lower inequality. But the effect here is basically ambiguous. It might be the case that you feel less threatened because the costs of immigrants not working will basically be distributed among all taxpayers. On the other hand, it may be exactly like you said, if you have generous social safety nets, they will actually become a bigger cost for the public sector, and they will be seen as more of a burden, which is actually work in the other direction here.
If I may, but you connected with generous social welfare state, but if you make immigrants unemployed and there is no social safety net, they can make money for their living by criminal activities and stuff like that.
Which also could annoy people, yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. That's true. So that's basically a general counter mechanism that would work in the opposite direction.
Also, one additional not just protective labor market institutions, more immigrant friendly attitudes. Maybe in Sweden, I don't know. In Central Europe, definitely the people are not afraid about the loss of their jobs, but they are afraid of foreigners.
That's actually true. That has been pointed to in several other papers. If you have generous social safety nets, people are less afraid of losing their job because there are unemployment benefits and so on. And that may actually also work in this direction through the social safety net. That's true. These are some really good points already. Anyway, now I'm curious, do we see similar patterns to this theory sketch in the data across countries? And perhaps more importantly, how do these explanations hold up against other theories of what explains labor market gaps? And the way I go about to check against data is to use basically country-level data from OECD and some other sources to test other explanations against my theory. So I'm going to show you two things that come out from this. First, basically just a graph of pairwise correlations, and when I discuss that, I will also introduce you to the variables that I use and explain what they measure. And then I'm going to give you the results from a Bayesian model. Averaging, which is how I handle the fact that I'm basically running regressions on 25 countries with several potential X variables. So there is large uncertainty on how the model should be specified. But let's first look at some correlations. So, and basically in this table, if you see a number, it is significant at 20% or higher. If the number has a star, it's significant at 10% or higher. If you don't see a number, the correlation is weaker than that. Okay, so this tells us basically about the pattern. The scatter plots I could potentially show. So these are the two measures of labor market gaps, one based on employment, the other on unemployment. They are highly related, but far from identical. And the theory holds up as far as the suggestion correlation with Gini, and where income inequality is higher, the gaps are much lower, and countries which have large gaps tend to have much lower income inequality. So this is basically Belgium, Sweden, and the Nordic countries, where the gap is high, but the income distribution is fairly compressed. And at the other end, we have United States, for example. Two measures of tolerance towards immigrants. This is the share that I showed you that favor low-skill immigration, and this is the one from the World Value Survey about being okay with having immigrants as neighbors. And we see that in terms of significance, this is slightly better, but it's still the case, interestingly, that the gaps are higher where tolerance is more common in the population. So that's the first scatter plot I showed you. And then to quantify protective institutions on the labor market, I use the OECD Index of Employment Protection Laws, which quantifies hiring and firing costs, last hired, first fired rules, and such. This is actually the average of the fixed and temporary contracts. If I wanted to look into dualism, I would probably want to use them separately because there might be something going on there. And then it is the share of the labor market that is covered by collective bargaining agreements. So in some countries where the labor movement has been influential, collective bargaining agreements cover more or less the entire labor market. And importantly, it is binding also for workers who are not members of a union. But the content of, and they regulate not only wages, but also working hours, how long and when you are allowed to work, and so on. The employment protection legislation doesn't really work as expected, whereas the collective bargaining coverage correlates exactly as expected. Countries with higher labor market gap have substantially higher collective bargaining coverage. They also have a much more compressed income distribution, and if anything, the correlation tolerance towards immigrants is actually positive. And it is strongly correlated also with the other measure of protective labor market institutions. Okay. As for the welfare state, I computed two measures. The one that I call safety net level. This is based on OECD data as well. They compute the level you are entitled to if you don't have a job and never have had a job based on the rules that apply in all OECD countries. And in many countries, you also need to make an assumption about your living costs or rents, and they have basically made assumptions about that as well. And I then relate this measure to the average wage in each OECD country. So the level is basically expressed as a relative level. It ranges from more than 40%, which I think is actually in Ireland. The Nordic countries also being fairly high, where if you don't have a job and you never had a job, you are still entitled to roughly a third of the average wage. Down to Italy and Greece, where these types of supports barely exist, according to the OECD data. So it's basically not the measure of welfare state size, but only the relative level of the lowest social safety net. This is the social expenditure as a share of GDP, straight from OECD's social expenditure database. It's basically a measure of the entire welfare state size, and it includes expenditure on healthcare and so on. And they correlate also, as expected. If you have more generous systems like this, you do have larger gaps, you have much smaller inequality, and people are more tolerant. So far, things look good for my proposed explanation. But of course, there are other ideas on what is explaining these gaps. So some might say it has to do with the immigrants, and in particular, whether they are educated enough to get a job in these advanced OECD labor markets. So I include a measure of the I've tried several, but the one that it's here is the share of immigrants that have higher tertiary education or higher. But I have also done the opposite than all measures I could think of. It doesn't correlate strongly with the labor market gaps, has some other interesting correlations. I include the immigrant share, because some might argue that this is basically a problem if you admit too many. And some might argue immigrants are okay, but if you have a high number of asylum seekers, basically refugee immigrants are different, especially if you have a high number of refugee immigrants in few years, you will have problems. And it turns out this is actually the number of asylum seekers per capita during the period 2000-2010. And those countries who are popular among refugees, they do have bigger gaps. And then I included two policy indices. There is a think tank or research institute or whatever that has quantified the quality of integration policies in all OECD countries. And by the way, they find that Sweden is one of the countries with actually the best, I think, integration policies. Interestingly, these do not correlate at all with the labor market gaps. And then there's basically the opposite. If policy is not focused towards integration, policy might be focused to allowing immigrants to keep their own culture. That's the multiculturalism policies. Doesn't do very much either, but actually is slightly negatively correlated with the labor market gap in terms of unemployment. So they are doing slightly better in countries which have more multiculturalist policies. But these are just correlations. And how would I go about to test these explanations against each other? I don't have individual level data. I have at least 9 possible X variables, and I have potentially 30 countries, but when I want data for all, I end up actually with at most 75 and at least 21 to 25 OECD countries. Which means it would be possible for me to show you 2 OLS regressions that fit my theory very nicely, but it's also possible that you would be highly skeptical towards that kind of evidence. So I've become rather fond of the statistical technique, which is based on Bayesian thinking. What time is it? How long have I?
20 minutes.
Okay, perfect. Here's my phone, that's good. That I don't know how familiar you are with, and probably that would vary. So the idea is basically, there's a very nice paper that was among the first to use this approach, which was called I Just Ran 2 Million Regressions, which was a paper that tried to put the final word into this research area of explaining growth. And they counted, I think, 64 variables that had been suggested to explain growth. And then they noted we barely have 64 rich countries in the world. So how do we actually test these theories against each other? And they suggested basically running all of them in all possible combinations. At that point, that was not possible. So they had to estimate quite advanced model. Here, thanks to rapid improvement in computer speed and also the fact that I have fewer variables and fewer countries, I can actually run all possible combinations of my X variables on the labor market outcomes and get a weighted average of the coefficient for each potentially explanatory X variable, where the weights are based on the explanatory value of the regressions with that variable included. Okay? So, and I don't even have to state if I want to include 1, 2, 3, or 4 variables, because all possible combinations of my X variables are included in the model, and the coefficients are weighted coefficients based on all theoretically possible models. And it also produces posterior inclusion probabilities in a Bayesian sense. So in Bayesian statistics, you have a prior, which sort of captures your view of how the world works before you are faced with data. And based on data, you update your priors and get the posterior view of the world. Now, the practice when you apply this model is to have naive priors, which basically mean that I assume that I have no prior theoretical idea about what X variables are better or belong in the true model. They are equally likely or actually equally unlikely. And the procedure reports updated priors based on how well the variables are doing in the regressions where they are included. Basically, I think the nice thing about this approach is that it gives very little freedom for the researcher to manipulate the results. Once you have decided about the variables you are testing and the outcome, there's very little to do. And you will get the results. I would like to mention this actually, because what I showed so far was basically based on ratios between unemployment for immigrants and natives. But it turns out it's actually very unlikely that the relationship between my explanatory variables will be linear towards a ratio measure. So what I do, and there's a second reason actually, and it is that labor markets, for various other reasons, tend to work differently and more or less well in different countries. So what I actually decided to do was to always include unemployment and employment for natives to control for whatever decides how well the labor market is functioning. And then explain the unemployment and employment for immigrants using the unemployment and employment for natives and any one of the other explanatory variables. So the coefficients will tell me something about how each variable affects the unemployment for immigrants when controlling for native unemployment, and so on. So I get to the relative effect, which is exactly, I don't want to explain variation in labor market functioning across countries. I want to explain the relative position of immigrants compared to natives in each country. That's the intuition behind this exercise, and I'm going to show you the result, and then I would be more or less done. So this is how results look, and here this means I have 25 countries. I explain unemployment among immigrants. I always include native unemployment. It's highly likely that that belongs in the model. Actually, I've decided, but it's also significant, and the coefficient is slightly above 1. That has a very plausible interpretation, which is that in countries where natives are unemployed to a high extent, immigrants are actually unemployed to a slightly higher extent. Okay? So if the labor market is doing well, there will be low unemployment among both natives and immigrants. And if the labor market is doing good, there will be low unemployment among both groups. But actually, unemployment will be slightly higher than native unemployment. And these are the variables that I want to test. And the interesting thing is actually the posterior inclusion probability, which is the Bayesian version of how sure can we be that this variable belongs in a true model. And in this case, which is actually the nicest I would probably be better off saving this one for last, but I haven't. So as you can see, the share of the labor market that is covered by collective bargaining agreements reaches 97% posterior inclusion probability, which means we are basically sure that this belongs in the true model, and it also has a very significant and large positive coefficient. So where the coverage of collective bargaining agreements is higher, these labor market gaps are also higher. And then there is some effect from the immigrant share in the population, employment protection legislation, and these are basically not doing anything, but this is also very low posterior inclusion probability. Note that I have 25 countries. That means I cannot, for example, test the policy index of MIPEX, Migrant Integration Policy, because it only covers 22 countries or something like that. So we'll be able to test that. I also run a slightly smaller sample. Reassuringly, collective bargaining still comes out of top, now with 0.8 inclusion probability. These policy indexes does not do more or less anything. Employment protection laws still. Some asylum seekers, but this is very, very, very low. So it's still only collective bargaining coverage that we can be somehow sure belongs in the model. And then I do the same thing for employment-based measures of the labor market gap. And then it actually doesn't look as good as for unemployment. Now it's actually the social safety net and the welfare state size that does best. Fairly low posterior inclusion probability, but still they do better than all the other things, so that's somehow supportive of my theory. And it basically means that the labor market gaps are bigger in countries with more generous welfare states. And those explanations do better than all the others. So the share of immigrants that have higher education have no explanatory variable value here. And doing the same for the slightly larger sample, again, the winner is collective bargaining coverage. Intolerance here actually does okay, and then come the welfare state generosity measures again.